Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 109, War and the Soul, August 31st, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Psychology doesn't tend to take into account enough regarding our coming of age of experiences, the way we turn into young men and young women, what was going on at that time and the experiences we had. Psychology has been prejudiced since Freud toward early childhood experiences. Well, of course, growing up during a war is profoundly affecting, and whether we went or didn't go, what we did during the war instead of the war profoundly affects the rest of our lives.
That was the voice of my guest, Edward Tick, PhD, who is a psychotherapist, writer, poet, mythologist, international journey guide, and transformational healer. He's been working with veterans and survivors of violence and trauma for 30 years, and he's founder and director of the nonprofit Soldier's Heart Foundation, dedicated to creating community-based veteran safe return initiatives across the country. He guides educational, healing, therapeutic, and reconciliation projects nationally and internationally. He leads regular healing journeys to Vietnam, Greece, and other countries. Dr. Tick is author of the award-winning book, War and the Soul, Healing Our Nation's Veterans from Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Other books by Dr. Tick are The Golden Tortoise, Vietnam Journeys, The Practice of Dream Healing, Bringing Ancient Greek Mysteries into Modern Medicine, and Sacred Mountain, Encounters with the Vietnam Beast. In all this work, Dr. Tick applies his own innovative, holistic, and spiritually based model of post-traumatic stress disorder treatment based on worldwide research into war and the warrior tradition to support the survivor in developing an enlarged and strengthened identity and spirituality that can carry, integrate, and give meaning to the traumatic experience. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Edward Tick, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. I'm honored to be with you.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here, and I should let our listeners know that my son, Matthew, who lives in New York City, is visiting, and he's going to be on the call with us. He's here in the studio, as it were, with me, and of course, Ed, you're located where?
I'm in Albany, New York.
Albany, New York. And Matthew, you want to say a word here?
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. That's it.
Okay, great. So, Ed, actually, it was one of my listeners who called my attention to your work and gave me a link to a speech that you had given that was on the internet. And so I listened to that speech, and it was such a wonderful and moving talk that I immediately knew that I wanted to have you as a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. And then you were kind enough to send me a copy of your most recent book, War and Soul, and I've been reading in that. And that's really wonderful. And to get us started, I would like to have you read the first couple of paragraphs from your introduction on page one, if you just read those first two paragraphs.
I'd be happy to. The mortars have stopped falling. The tracers have stopped screaming. The mountains, jungles, and villages have stopped smoldering. But years later, veterans still have nightmares and flashbacks in which old battles still rage. They still watch for threats and stand poised for danger. Their hearts respond to everyday situations as though they were vicious attacks, and to ordinary relationships as though they were with long-gone comrades and enemies. Though hostilities cease and life moves on, and though loved ones yearn for their healing, Veterans often remain drenched in the imagery and emotion of war for decades, and sometimes for their entire lives. For these survivors, every vital human characteristic that we attribute to the soul may be fundamentally reshaped. These traits include how we perceive, how our minds are organized and function, how we love and relate, what we believe, expect, and value, what we feel and refuse to feel, and what we judge as good or evil, right or wrong. Though the affliction that today we call post-traumatic stress disorder has had many names over the centuries, it is always the result of the way war invades, wounds, and transforms our spirit.
And that's such a good lead-in to the book and to your work. And by the way, if there are other passages that you'd like to share with us as we move on into the interview, please feel free to put them in wherever it makes sense. So perhaps you could tell us a bit about your work and how you came to write this book.
Well, I am not a veteran myself. I am of the Vietnam generation. I'm 56 years old now. I turned 18 in 1969 at the height of the war. And psychology doesn't tend to take into account enough regarding our coming-of-age experiences, the way we turn into young men and young women, what was going on at that time and the experiences we had. Psychology has been prejudiced since Freud toward early childhood experiences. Well, of course, growing up during a war is profoundly affecting, and whether we went or didn't go, what we did during the war instead of the war profoundly affects the rest of our lives. So I was in college and protesting the war. My first year in college, the student deferments were ended and the lottery system was instituted. And I really wasn't sure what I would do if I were pulled from college and drafted. I was utterly against the war and actively protesting it. I thought about going to war as a medic because I felt responsibility and obligation to serve and to be by the side, sharing the dangers that some of our generation wore. But I was also against the war, and I was working on my conscientious objectively. And then I got a high lottery number, and suddenly, personally, I was off the hook. The war still went on, of course. Lots of people stopped protesting when they were no longer personally endangered. I kept protesting, and then the war ended, we all remember, in 1975. I'm fast-forwarding a few years now. After college, I relocated to a rural part of central New York State, and it was an area in which many Vietnam veterans, both from rural and poor families and also New York City refugees who could no longer handle the stress of the big city, all relocated to this rural area. And by the late 70s, I was a young psychotherapist beginning to learn and practice the art and calling, and veterans started to come into my practice. Now, post-traumatic stress disorder was not entered as a diagnostic category in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual until 1980. So this was before we, in the contemporary world, knew about PTSD. But it was very clear to me, working with these veterans, what was wrong, how profoundly distorted and disturbed they had become by their war experiences. And in contrast, what I had escaped and what others of our generation escaped and didn't suffer.
Yes, I escaped as well. I was in graduate school at the time, and so was able to get a deferment by virtue of both being in graduate school, being married, eventually having children. But I don't want to interrupt your narrative. Go ahead.
Your comment is important in that whatever we experienced at the time, whether we went to war or avoided it and how we avoided it, profoundly affected how we developed as adults and
yes,
later behaviors and values and lifestyles. And I'll throw in the footnote that I've worked with so many men of the Vietnam generation who are not veterans, And most of them as well have had to come to terms with not serving and how that shaped and affected them, and whether or not they feel like they ever became men or ever gave forms of alternative service. So what we did or didn't do is of utmost importance.
Yes, I see.
Well, what happened for me was that beginning to work with veterans, I felt profound concern and compassion for them. And also, I'm thinking of James Hillman's book, A Terrible Love of War. I felt in myself the curiosity and attraction, not to war in that I wanted to go, but a fascination with trying to understand, really comprehend from within what the experience of war was like, what happened to our peers in Vietnam, what they went through, what they saw, what they did, what its impact on was them, what happened to the Vietnamese. And it became a compelling area of investigation for me. In addition, the need was so great, as it is today, for veterans healing, and there in our contemporary culture seems to be so little known about how to treat it, that I really got swept up into this work as into a life calling.
Well, let's talk about treatment there for a moment, because in the book you say conventional treatment for PTSD is not sufficient. So maybe you can talk about in what ways it falls short.
Sure.
It sounded like I derailed you from somewhere else that you were going, though, so feel free
right.
to finish
fact,
that thought.
I'll put them together. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for noticing that, but I can put the end of my story together quickly with your important question about treatment. I gave the best conventional therapy I possibly could at the time for my first 8 years of work with veterans. And by the time, it was the mid-1980s, when I had quite significant numbers of cases and enough years of experience with veterans, and it wasn't only treatment, I became very involved in veteran advocacy. I was a member of an advisor to a number of their organizations, and also training other therapists and doing veteran work. So what I discovered is that the experience of war is so debilitating, so terrifying, so utterly unlike anything in civilian life. It penetrates to the core of our being. It changes every aspect of the self, as I said in the introductory remark you had me read. It changes how we think, how we feel. It changes the shape of our minds. It changes us physiologically. It propels us into questions of ultimate concern rather than everyday trivial concern. Why am I here? Why did I survive? What makes human beings able to be so cruel and bestial? It changes our moral sensibilities. We become, in war, we become agents of death and destruction, when in life we want to be agents of creation and life affirmation. So I learned through the doing of psychotherapy as best I could, and also through investigating this problem quite extensively with other therapists, with veterans, and eventually doing worldwide study in search of the warrior tradition around the world and other times, other places, other cultures, both present and past, that war wounds us too holistically, too thoroughly on every level of our being, such that conventional therapy can be helpful, certainly, and can help mitigate or ameliorate post-traumatic stress disorder and its symptoms, but it doesn't penetrate us deeply enough. It doesn't go far enough. It can't touch us and transform us holistically enough by itself so that post-traumatic stress disorder truly heals. And while I had very good experiences and success in helping many veteran clients, I took the calling to look for healing from post-traumatic stress disorder very seriously and began studying, investigating, practicing more spiritually based and holistic forms of healing, and then adapting them to working with veterans and other war survivors, and found that, in fact, when we add other components, in particular spiritual components, and draw on archetypal and mythological traditions and use them in therapy, and also when we step beyond the therapy setting and respond to the pain, anger, and grief that is in the center of post-traumatic stress disorder, and in the center of the veteran's experience, and look for real-world action steps that directly answer the wound, that we really can bring significant and even sometimes complete healing and transformation to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, we'll come back maybe towards the end of the interview. We'll come back more to some of the actual treatment interventions that you've developed. But I'm interested in exploring more the mythological and the spiritual dimensions here that you've alluded to. You talk about this as being a wound to the soul, that the soul is kind of ripped out of these soldiers. And I have to say that you write beautifully about the soul and talking about what the soul is. Some of the best writing on that topic that I've seen, very sort of clear and down to earth, and not all that mystical. So perhaps you can say something about why you've chosen to see this as a wound to the soul, and just exactly how you define the soul.
Well, perhaps we'll start with how I define the soul.
Okay.
And then talk about how it's wounded. I actually find it one of the many tragic dimensions of the age in which we live. The age in which we love.
And live.
We can say, stop there. one of the tragic dimensions of our age is that we even have to try to define the soul and enter into arguments about whether there is a soul, and try to provide scientific validity for a concept that has been around as long as human beings have, and that most cultures and most times and places have taken as a de facto aspect of existence. So the simplest way I would say that the soul is the center of our being, the divine spark that is planted in every one of us. That mysterious thing that differentiates us from dead matter. But we can't know the soul directly, and instead we know it by all of its traits and attributes. And it has been defined variously throughout time by philosophers and theologians as poets, really by its attributes. So the soul has been known as the center of human consciousness and experience, that which makes us aware, that which gives us self-consciousness. It's been differentiated from the body. It's not the body, but the principle that awakens and vivifies the body, that turns just matter into something more, something special. It's been known as the vital spirit that creates and preserves life.
I think you also talk about it as the part of us that is drawn to beauty and appreciates beauty.
Yes, Plato said that beauty is the food for the soul, and the soul is that, just what you said, that which is drawn to and appreciates and perceives beauty. It's also been associated with the heart, that some cultures say that our soul dwells in our heart, and that what we feel and how we feel and why we feel comes from the soul. It's also been associated with our moral sensibilities, and this is very important in understanding the impact of war, because our morality is turned on its head during war and destruction. So Socrates said that the soul is that in us which differentiates right from wrong, good from evil. And so we can say the soul is the seat of our moral system as well. Other philosophers have said the soul is the seat of our will, and that we know that we are soulful people because when we are motivated from within, driven by our will, that comes from the soul, and that we can observe people who have been wounded in their soul by people who don't have inner drive or will or motivation. If there's something trying to unfold in us, we have a daemon or a genius or a purpose that we're driven toward, and the soul wants to fulfill that purpose, and if we are flat and without will or motivation, then we may be wounded in the soul and lost our sense of uniqueness and purpose. So all I define the soul as the source and the seat of all of these traits.
In your book, you tell stories of interactions with veterans who seem to respond immediately to this, to addressing them about issues of soul.
Oh, it's quite remarkable and beautiful. And this actually helps us understand certain unique dimensions of the war experience. Veterans, of course, have been transformed by both their military and their war experiences, and it's even important to differentiate those, because the military experience is transformative, and it's meant to be. And so people who have been in the military, even if they've never been to war, but only served stateside, served perhaps during peacetime, or had safe, secure stateside jobs or overseas jobs and were not exposed to violence, has still been transformed by military training and duty and service. And the military, of course, seeks to transform a civilian into a soldier or sailor or marine, and substitute different shapes to all of the soul traits, so that people are trained to think and to feel and to act and to believe differently according to military rules and dictates. In addition to that, someone who has been to war is transformed again by quite, and this certainly gets us into the mythological dimensions. A person who's been to war has been to hell. When General Sherman famously said, "War is hell," from the civilian world, we tend to take that as a metaphor. War is like hell, or war is like how we imagine hell to be. But war survivors are not speaking metaphorically. War really is a living hell, and people who have been to it have been transformed by their time in hell. And so all of the soul functions have been affected and transformed according to the rules and principles of hell. Now, veterans often, because they've been to hell, and because one of the ways we can understand post-traumatic stress disorder is a consciousness that has been shocked by its descent into hell and got stuck there. PTSD is a form of consciousness, an altered state of consciousness, whereby the mind and the heart and the soul are still operating as if they are at war, as if they are still in hell. Mm-hmm. They haven't come back. And so vets understand and readily talk about the ultimate dimensions. The very first case I report in my book, War in the Soul, was of a Vietnam combat veteran who was at the siege of Khe Sanh. And he, on his own, spontaneously, during our very first therapy session, described to me his experience of losing his soul during the battle at Kaesong. I often introduce soul language and soul talk, and I use mythical stories and language with veterans, and they quite readily respond. It's very easy for them to describe their combat experiences in soulful terms or with reference to mythological stories.
Let me just interject for a moment that that's very interesting, because these are people who are famously edgy, suspicious, often angry, hostile, and particularly to people who have not been to war themselves and who've not shared that experience. Somehow you're able to very quickly bond with them and get them to accept you. Why do you think that's the case?
I'd say there are a few reasons. One is that, as we're saying, I immediately do soul talk with them. I know they've been utterly transformed and are living in a different realm of consciousness. And I speak, there's a shamanic analogy here as well, and later we can talk about the usefulness of shamanism in helping to heal PTSD. But, of course, the essence of shamanism is that the shaman travels in the spirit world in service to his patients. And whenever I'm with a veteran, especially a combat veteran, I know that they're in another world. Their souls are still there. And I think of post-traumatic stress disorder as that condition. The soul is stuck in the underworld. Mm-hmm. And so I go there with them and talk and seek to join them where they are in the underworld and create a relationship there, showing them that I know the ways of the underworld. I get it. Veterans are looking for people who get it, who really comprehend how profoundly disturbed, distorted, violent their world is and the consciousness they're stuck in. So I don't try to drag veterans back to the civilian world. I don't believe that the civilian form of consciousness is necessarily better. I don't assume that they should be functioning in our everyday form of consciousness, but rather I seek to join them in the archetypal world they are dwelling in because of their descent into hell. And then we work together to find our way back out of that world.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about war as a rite of passage, and it seems like our culture in particular is lacking in rites of passage that other cultures have had, as particularly for adolescent males who seem to have a drive for adventure and risk and so on. And I know that as an adolescent, late adolescence, I put my life at risk from what an adult perspective would now seem kind of foolish ways.
And in some ways, at the time.
No, it didn't seem foolish at
right?
the time. And
no,
also, I think I was growing up during World War II, as I did, and then also living through the Vietnam era.
Yeah.
As a male, I was always girding myself psychically for war.
Yes.
Dreading it. I figured it was inevitable that I might have to go to war. And so the games of childhood and adolescence often centered around that kind of preparation and testing of courage and so on.
Yes, well, that was true for me as well. And that was the dominant experience for almost all males growing up, not just in American culture, but most times and places in history. Of course, there are variations between individuals and cultures about the degree to which males are prepared for war. as they grow up, and also the attitudes toward war and how we should prepare. But beyond those individual and cultural variations, warfare has been nearly universal experience throughout recorded history. I don't think it's so throughout all of history, but since we've had mass urban civilizations, and since we transitioned from the matriarchy to the patriarchy, and since we've had written records, so we're talking about approximately the last 5,000 or so years of history. Scholars count over 15,000 wars with definitive outcomes in the last 5,000 years. They don't even try to count all the wars that were fought to a draw. So we're talking about three or four wars a year going on anywhere around the world for all of recorded history. And there are very few cultures we know of that did not have wars, warriors, or even a word for war. There are a few, but those cultures were quite isolated. They weren't threatened by neighbors. They didn't have to compete for land or food supplies. So some tribes in the Amazon rainforest, Minoan civilization in ancient Crete, didn't have or need warriors. But beyond that, it seems to be nearly universal human experience. War in traditional times and among traditional peoples was much more limited in the extent of danger, damage, destructiveness that was practiced. And Jungian psychology has recognized that we have what we call a warrior archetype built into our psyches that needs to be developed, expressed. Its energies and traits need to be channeled. So all of these things say to me that some form of conflict and the identity of warrior are universal or nearly universal in human experience, and we can't just wish or want to be at peace, but rather need to face and channel the competitive and conflicting and aggressive parts of ourselves and develop some kind of warrior identity. And that males in particular have this built into our psyches and will seek, as you rightly observed, spontaneously seek risk-taking behavior, challenging ordeals, and need rites of passage to develop the warrior part of ourselves. The bigger problems emerge, of course, in the ways particular cultures, especially our American culture, uses or misuses, misdirects the urge toward warriorhood for violent political and economic ends.
Okay, I think I think Matthew wants to ask a question here or make a comment.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me, Ed, when you were speaking about, you know, over a 5,000-year span, 1,500 wars being fought, and of course
15,000, Matthew.
Oh, 15,000, I'm sorry.
I wish it were only 1,500. 15,000 in 5,000 years. Yeah.
I'm sorry. So, and this idea that it spans almost every culture, every civilization, this idea of warriorhood. And I was going to ask, it sounds like this is what you're getting to now, but how our culture has, you know, where one warrior might be fighting over territory or for agricultural purposes or what have you, and then taking a war like the Vietnam War, where to so many of the young men who must have had to go and fight, and a lot of the young men that who didn't, how arbitrary that war must have seemed, and especially the process like a lottery, how arbitrary that might have seemed, and how they might prepare themselves for that. Is that?
Yes, that's a very good point, and it really gets to the heart of our challenge here. If we discover together that the warrior archetype is built into us, especially us males, and we need to test it, train it, improve it somehow, and we are attracted to risk-taking behavior, and we'll get involved in challenging and confronting activities in order to evolve the warrior part of us. That's one part of us that is biological, psychological, spiritually based. Mm-hmm. And men of all times and places are attracted to it, and we play games in childhood to prepare for it, and we try to unfold it in our adulthood. That is really different than mass technological warfare as we practice it in the modern era. Two men facing off on an open field with fists or swords or spears are a different matter than 10,000 men facing off with weapons of horrific destructive capabilities, wiping each other out in horrible numbers and maiming the ones who aren't killed and driving everybody else crazy. So war has transformed from a rite of passage and an ordeal of testing, a form of male development, to a practice of mass slaughter that kills, maims, or drives mad nearly everyone who participates in it. However, it's extraordinary how attractive war still is to people. Our military uses the old form of attraction to hook people into signing up. So we see commercials on television, for example, or in the movie theaters or literature showing a proud Marine with a sword or a laser beam slaying a dragon. Mm-hmm. We are told, be an army of one.
Right.
There's no such thing as an army of one. You can't be an army of one. And in the modern era, if you try to be an army of one, you might last a second on the battlefield. But the mythic attraction to warriorhood is still used to call people into service, and it's manipulated, and more profoundly, it's what young people are looking for. So we're at a very strange place in our evolution where war has become so destructive that it is anachronistic to the mythic calling, but young people by the millions are still attracted to the mythic calling and will enlist and go off to war thinking that they can fulfill it, that they can be a Grail Knight who going off to rescue Iraq all by themselves. And part of the trauma is when you get to the battlefield, you find out, oh, there's no glory here. There are no heroics here. It is, in fact, a mass destruction and matter of utmost chance who lives and who dies. It's not about me being smarter or faster or better swordsman or a more clever spy. It's just where the mortars and bombs fall and where the shrapnel flies. And so we seek warriorhood experience, but in and the mythic warrior is wiped out by the experience of modern war.
You know, that might relate to something else that you said in the book where you say PTSD is not best understood as a stress disorder, but rather as an identity disorder.
Yes, it relates well. Veterans tend to hate the phrase PTSD because it pathologizes them and because it rates them in relation to civilian functioning when they know they have become something else. their identity has been changed forever by the experience of both the military and combat if they were in it. Since the entire person has changed and they are in a new identity, it makes much more sense to help them recreate an identity that includes the military and war experiences with the thoughts, the feelings, the meanings, the values that a warrior carries.
Well, let's talk about that, because I know you've studied many traditions to develop an approach to the healing of these wounded warriors, and you've drawn on shamanic practices, the ancient Greeks, Native American traditions, Vietnamese traditions, and others. And out of all of that, you've developed some specific techniques to promote soul healing.
Yes.
Go ahead and tell us about that.
Well, of course, most people are aware that we do a woeful job in bringing our veterans home. We spend so much time, effort, and money transforming them into soldiers, sailors, and Marines, and then giving them the military experience. And then homecoming is supposed to be quick and easy, as if it were simply enough to take them out of the war zone, get them home as quickly as possible, tell them they're out of danger now, and get back to civilian life. It's not possible. And the extent of PTSD and all the associated problems, suicide and homicide and substance abuse and homelessness, broken marriages, failed employment, all of that is evidence that you cannot just be taken back home, dumped on safe soil, and told to get on with your life. It doesn't work.
And evidently, even tribal traditions acknowledge that, knew that, that the Native Americans, for example, I think you talk about traditions that they had for reintegrating the warrior back into tribal life.
Yes, I, as you rightly observed, I've studied not and practiced with Native American people and also with other traditions to study this very question. Since other traditions had warriors, I hoped and assumed that they might have had more wisdom in how to bring their warriors home. So, for example, in the Native American tradition, tribes had extensive ceremonies and rituals by which they brought their warriors home. And they didn't wait, as we do, for a year or two or three in the combat zone before they began working to heal the impact of war. But rather, for example, in my book, I extensively reference the practices of the Papago people. It's a great example. There are others we could quote as well. But among the Papagos, they had a 19-day ceremony of return for a young warrior after his first battle experience in which he had encounters with death. So you could be on the battlefield for 1 hour, and you would need almost 3 weeks of attention in order to return safely to your home. And there were many aspects of the ritual of return that are worth studying carefully to see how we can transform our warriors' identities from young man whose innocence has been blown away into a mature warrior with a different identity who can carry the experience. Some of the qualities of the rituals, and these are cross-cultural qualities. Some of the qualities include the necessity for purification and cleansing after a combat experience, the importance of storytelling. Some of our contemporary practices don't even allow veterans to tell their war stories, but rather say, for example, stress reduction techniques often teach trauma survivors to avoid the memory and never talk about the story because that'll trigger the symptoms. Mm. That's exactly the opposite of traditional wisdom that says the stories must be told there is healing power in storytelling, and the stories must be told to the tribe you serve. So we need purification.
And I would think that the story would be honored, that would be part of it.
Yes, that's quite an important part. Yes, the story is honored, and the warrior is never condemned for his part in the story. The story is even more than honored. The individual warrior's story becomes the warrior mythology of the tribe or culture. So it's even more than honoring the story. Mm-hmm. It's letting the survivor know that he is held in high regard and that what he did was for the people, to preserve and protect the people. The primary purpose of participating in war was not to cause death and destruction, but rather a warrior actually has positive and affirmative motivations of protection and preservation of the people. So even if people disagreed with the conflict or the politics behind it, they didn't blame the warrior for that, as we unfortunately did during Vietnam. But they saw that the warrior's impulse was to preserve and protect the people, and that he was willing to give great sacrifice, even unto sacrificing his life. And so that willingness and sacrifice was always honored. And even further, another necessary ingredient that traditional cultures practice and we don't is restitution, where in the family and the nation, where the warrior returning home goes through processes of transferring the responsibility that he feels for the actions he took to the tribe or to the culture. So in Native American societies, part of the ritual for bringing the warrior home was hearing his stories in all kinds of ways. Verbal storytelling, what we would call expressive arts therapy, you know, painting your shields, painting your stories on your teepee, doing the war dance. The war dance originally was not to whip oneself into a frenzy to go off and fight. The war dance was psychodramatic reenactment of the battle after you came home, to turn the energies of combat into an art form that could tell the stories to the culture, and also discharge the emotions that are and the physiological reactions that are still galloping through the warrior. After the stories were told in these many different ways, then the civilians of the tribe would turn to the warrior and, through ritual, lift the responsibility for the actions off the tribe, off the warrior. So they essentially said, you did these actions in our name, therefore we are all responsible. We carry whatever feelings you have are our feelings. You're not guilty. You don't have to be ashamed. You did this for us. We are responsible for carrying it. This is something that our culture has utterly refused to do. We leave the burden of the actions during war on the individual soldiers, and when our wars are so morally and politically suspect as they have been throughout our lifetimes, the soldiers collapse under the moral pain and trauma of their actions, while our culture doesn't take responsibility and lift them off the veterans.
Well, that sounds like such wonderful work, and I know that you've taken these notions and you've concretized them in your own work in terms of developing rituals and other processes to use with groups of veterans. I wish we had more time. Unfortunately, it's got to be a somewhat time-limited interview here. I have lots more questions. Your book is so provocative, but we probably need to begin to wind down here. I'm under the impression that you're working on another book. Can you say anything about what you're working on?
Oh, yes. Thank you for inviting that. I just have a monograph that just came out, and you would be interested in some of your listeners as well, I think. It's called Wild Beasts and Wandering Souls, and it is specifically the use of shamanism for understanding and treating post-traumatic stress disorder. That's hot off the press from Ellick Press in Salt Lake City. It's just a 30-page or so monograph focusing on shamanism and how I use it for veterans. Beyond that, I'm presently working on a book that should be out by next summer or fall, which is an answer to some of the questions you're asking. Many clinicians and clergy and community leaders from around the country have read my book, War in the Soul, and they basically said, how do we do this? Thank you for helping us understand post-traumatic stress disorder from the standpoint of the soul. But how do we really do the work, and what kind of programs should we be creating in our houses of worship and in our communities that can truly help our veterans transition home from these new wars? So my new book is going to be a guidebook for how to actually do soul-based and community-based healing with veterans and war survivors.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I know that you've got a workshop coming up in September somewhere in the Midwest. What can you tell us about that?
Thanks. Several upcoming events that your listeners might be interested in. The weekend of mid-September, September 13th through 16th, I'm running an intensive retreat in Wheaton, Illinois, right outside Chicago, at the national headquarters of the Theosophical Society. And this will be a four-day intensive retreat for veterans, clinicians, clergy, family members of veterans, where we will immerse together in the soul healing work necessary for helping veterans come home. I'll be in your territory in mid-October, also the middle of October. It's the 16th through the 19th. I'll be presenting this work at the annual Bioneers Conference in San Rafael.
Oh, yes, that's just down the road from me. I hope that you'll let me know about that. I'd love to get together with you.
Great. Let's plan that. Thank you.
Okay.
And then right after that, on the 19th, I lead healing journeys back to Vietnam every year for veterans and others, because all of us Americans have reconciliation work to do with Vietnam. So from the Bioneers Conference, I leave directly for Vietnam, and I take about a dozen vets and their loved ones and anybody else interested in a profound healing journey back to Vietnam. So those are all coming up in the next couple of months.
Okay,
some of the ways I make this work active.
Great. I'll try to put we'll put a link to your website on the show notes of this show so that people
Wonderful.
Will be able
Thank
to
you.
Track you down. And
Edward, thank you for allowing me to sit in on the interview. Fascinating, fascinating, and I think really important work. I had a number of questions, but I could see the time winding down. I really didn't want to cut into my dad's time, but I look forward to reading the book myself. And I read a couple of passages, and I agree with everything that my dad said. It's a compelling, very emotional read. So thank you for allowing me to sit in on your interview, and best of luck.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to have you. And it is of utmost importance that in every form we can, we get people gathering in small groups and large all over the country and world, really wrestling with these issues.
I agree.
I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, Dr. Edward Tick, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome. Honored to be with you, Dr. Dave.
Okay, so as you know, I usually do a little post-interview commentary, and I thought, since I have my son Matthew here, who was in on the interview, that he and I could have a little conversation. So, Matthew, I'm wondering what portions of that interview touched you as a 26-year-old who is potentially draftable if they reinstitute the draft and so on. So a lot of this about the warrior and rites of passage and so on, I think would apply pretty directly to you.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned that, because one of the topics that touched me was when you talked about coming of age during World War II, or growing up during World War II, rather, and then being draftable during the Vietnam War, and so kind of having to girdle yourself for these potential experiences, I didn't have to deal with any of that coming after the Vietnam generation. And I always – it was always kind of understood that the draft was a thing of the past, that the nature of how we enlist our Army now has changed, and so that I wouldn't have to worry about it. And it's true that there's been talk of a draft in recent years, but – Even then, it seemed pretty unlikely that I would have to go. So no, I never really had to gird myself against it in the same way that you or Ed would have. But I found it, you know, really interesting when he was talking about it being a universal archetypal rite of passage for young men to experience that desire or you know, to prepare themselves in that way.
Well, you've done some young man adventure type things, haven't you?
Yeah.
I probably don't even know all of them.
Yeah, but I think that they are dramatically different from warfare.
Yes,
the idea
definitely.
Of maybe I don't disillusion myself in the way that some young men do. Maybe they see the Army commercials, maybe they see the Marine foeing up against the dragon like Ed was talking about and have this idealized heroic vision of themselves. No, I think war would be hell. I don't feel I harbor any illusions, and I think it's a terrible, traumatic thing for any young person to have to experience. And what I was kind of hinting at with Ed, and what is curious to me is, I think there's a real difference, and he was talking about this, between if we're looking at a Native American tribe, and there's a direct connection between the warrior going out to battle. I think there's a direct connection to his tribe and to his livelihood and to the territory that he's looking to.
Well, you're saying he knows what he's fighting for.
Precisely right.
Yeah,
the lines aren't as blurred. And it makes sense then that all the advertisements and commercials that we see today seek to elicit those same kind of whatever you would call them. But
right. Well, let me shift it just a little bit, because
sure.
Your life is not untouched by what's going on in Iraq, because I know you have at least one good high school buddy
mm-hmm.
who had his legs blown off.
Mm-hmm.
What's that been like for you? I mean, that must have brought this war home to you in a different kind of way.
It definitely did. It definitely did. What a very good friend of mine went to fight voluntarily in Iraq and lost a leg to what do you call them? An improvised explosive device.
Right.
I think something like IED, one of those roadside bombs. And I would travel to the hospital there at Walter Reed in Washington every weekend, every other weekend or so. And I was with him for maybe 15 of the 35 plus surgeries that he had. And he kept losing more and more of his leg, eventually losing almost all of it. Now, as far as post-traumatic stress disorder is concerned, I don't know that Dan is suffering from that or that he has suffered from that. I think that it's a real possibility for the future. How can it not be to be in such a scary area? And that definitely personalized the war for me in a big way, because if anything, it just felt even more senseless. But his politics are real different from mine. And so, you know, at the end of the day, it just hurts to see a friend in pain.
He was okay with it, I gather. And you're saying he signed up for patriotic reasons. And does he regret? I'm sure he regrets the loss of his legs. Does he regret having served and having gone over there?
Yeah, he only lost the loss of one leg,
okay.
Not both. But Does he regret having served there? I don't think that he would regret that. It's kind of complicated. He'd been involved in the armed services for a long time. He was about, 32 or 33 when this happened. So he was just part of the National Guard at that point and was doing it to pay for he had almost achieved full retirement benefits or what have you. So he was just doing it for that reason. It was a spate of bad luck. I don't think he wanted to go to Iraq. I don't think he had any desire to go to Iraq now that I'm remembering it. But he did have to go, and then his stay was extended, and then he was supposed to go home, and that was extended. So he was a little upset about that. I mean, he was definitely upset about that and ticked off. But no, I think that if you were to ask him if he regretted fighting in Iraq, I don't think that he would answer yes.
Do you have any other friends or who are in Iraq or who've been wounded there?
Not currently. There was a friend of ours from my days at the JC named Demetrius Contrariotis. I know he fought in Iraq. I don't know that he was wounded, but I'm not in touch with him anymore. And no, that's the extent of it. I'm fortunate of one of those two.
What did you think of what Ed was talking about, the soul and loss of soul? And I wonder, what impact did that have on you as a 26-year-old, which might be very different than, my being really steeped in all of this stuff might be different for you?
I found it really compelling, rephrasing the question in terms of identity. I found really compelling. I remember studying the Vietnam War briefly in high school, reading books like Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, and understanding that this was a war where the men were so young and the terrain was so different and the country, for the most part, was so opposed. And he's right. When these young men came back, they couldn't – there was no one to talk to. Largely, I think, that the country turned their backs – on these boys because they were so opposed to this war that for political or socioeconomic reasons they didn't really understand or didn't support, understandably. And so I think that dealing – my guess is that the Vietnam War produced more PTSD or PTSD rather – cases than the other wars. That would be my guess, just because of the special chemistry that war produced.
Yeah, I think my question to you is whether or not the soul talk was something that you could relate to and identify with or not.
It makes sense to me, but I think that really it has to do with where these soldiers are coming from, mm-hmm. This nightmare, this hell that he described, would talking about the soul help me in any way? Maybe, probably, but it seems removed. It doesn't seem as directly applicable as to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, well, is there any other comment that you'd like to make before we wrap this up or any question you want to ask me?
Just that I hope a lot of people have an opportunity to listen to this episode. I think he's an exceptionally interesting individual and obviously charismatic and well-spoken. And I look forward to reading the book. I really do. I wasn't just saying that. And I admire him for taking it upon himself to kind of explore this issue. Because I believe these soldiers need help, and I don't think it's being addressed in any way, really. And what your listeners didn't get to hear was this wonderful kind of personal frame of reference from Edward after you turned off the recorder, and you joked that sometimes the best parts of interviews come after the recorder is off. But he was talking about why he did it and what's compelled him to do it and going off on solo ventures really in an effort to help soldiers suffering from this disability, and I think it's important.
That notion must have jumped right from my head over to your head, because I was thinking about that very thing just before you said it. I was thinking, oh, I want to tell them about how I regretted turning off the tape recorder, as often I do, because then the guests, they kind of let their hair down, and we start talking in probably a more natural fashion. And I put the question to him, how does a guy like you who's on the East Coast and went to traditional East Coast type schools, you know, all this soul talk and so on is very prevalent on the West Coast, much less prevalent on the East Coast,
particularly
where it's a lot more conservative.
Northern California.
Growing up in New York and so on, as Ed did. And he shared with us, and I don't think he would mind my sharing this with you at large, that he actually had a vision at 4 years of age, and that vision helped to shape his life. And then later, he went to, I guess he traveled to Vietnam. He traveled to Greece.
To Greece in 1987.
Oh, what a good memory you have. And he traveled to Greece to try to study the mythological roots of war and so on. And he had, I guess, one or more visions there.
It sounded like several kind of life-changing, life-altering, spiritual awakenings.
Yeah, I think he described them as shamanic visions, and he felt prompted to return to the U.S. to meet with Native American elders who could help him integrate this into his life. And, you know, and he said as a result of all of this, he feels like he has a calling. And I would have to say, having heard him speak both the first time, reading the book, interviewing him just now, he definitely is someone with a calling.
I would agree. I would agree.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
I think we've run long enough that there's not going to be time today to go over any of the emails. I want to thank our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. And remember, you can get a discount when you check out at GoDaddy.com by using the discount code SHRINK3. So you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages on MyChingo and just click on the logo on our website. And you can leave voicemail at 206-337-0622. It's been a long time since I've gotten any voicemail. So my thanks to Dr. Edward Tick for a very insightful and moving interview, and also to my son, Matt Van Nuys. I'm not sure what's on for next week, actually. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.